Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to Unheard. I'm Freddie Sayers. So Vladimir Putin has given as his main reason for invading Ukraine the need to denazify the country. Understandably, the Western media is careful about this topic because they don't want to add any fuel to the fire or give any cover for his reason for invading. But what's the truth? Is there a Nazi problem in Ukraine? We're here with Aris Rusinos, a Unheard contributor. You've actually spent time inside Ukraine with the neo-Nazi components, and you're able, hopefully, in the next half hour, to give us a sense of what the truth is. Clearly, it's not a reason to invade a country, but what is, in your estimation, the reality of the Nazi problem in Ukraine?
It's obviously a very controversial, very contested topic in a very heated media space at the moment. So I think it's important to emphasize that Putin's claim fundamentally is that in 2014 there was a fascist coup, when he's talking about the Maidan revolution, and he claims that since 2014 Ukraine has been essentially run by a neo-Nazi government. That's obviously absolutely not true. That's not the case. But there is a danger, because Russia uses this, you know, for propaganda purposes, there's a danger to overcorrect too much, not to give him ammunition and to deny that there's any kind of, you know, neo-Nazi or extreme right component. That's not true. So, like, you know, even on listening to the news on BBC Radio 4 the other day, they're talking about Putin's baseless accusation that the Ukrainian state supports Nazis. And that's not a baseless accusation.
So the Ukrainian state does support Nazis?
There are groups like the Azov Regiment who do have fundamentally a neo-Nazi ideology. They're founded in 2014 by Andriy Beletsky, During the Maidan Revolution, they took part very actively fighting the riot police, overthrowing...
Who's Andriy Beletsky?
He's a Ukrainian neo-Nazi. I mean, he was a member of a neo-Nazi... He was a leader of a neo-Nazi group called Patriot of Ukraine.
And in what sense are they neo-Nazi? Because this is a phrase that's kind of bandied around. What does it actually mean in a Ukrainian context?
Yeah, in the past few years, like almost everything kind of rightward of conservative has been called fascist or Nazi, right? But in a very specific sense, they are literally Nazis. In that, so like, you know, like there's a quote from Beletsky back from his time in Patriot of Ukraine from I think 2010, when he says that Ukraine's mission is to lead the white race to fight against the Semite-led Untermensch of the world.
That does sound quite Nazi.
It sounds quite Nazi.
It's an ethnic white supremacist vision. That's their politics, is it? That they want some kind of restoration of a white-only culture? Or?
So I've spent time with Elena Semeniaka, who's the Azov Movement's international director, who's their kind of linchpin for coordinating with far-right and extreme-right groups across Europe and in North America. And she sees Azov's mission as part of a spiritual revival of Europe and the West. So the idea is that, you know, the liberal order is crumbling, that it's weak, that it shouldn't exist, and that Europe should be reconquered. I mean, they had an event space called Reconquista in Kiev that, you know, that speaks to this idea of a reconquest of Europe away from liberalism.
So they want a restoration of kind of ultra-conservative values, expunging immigrants or gays?
Yeah, no immigrants, no non-whites. Azov has a strong kind of neo-pagan aspect, so... there are other far-right and extreme-right units in Ukraine, militias in Ukraine that have a kind of strong Orthodox ideology.
Christian Orthodox.
Yeah, Eastern Orthodox. Azov are essentially neo-pagan. Like they, you know, they're against Christianity. They use a lot of kind of, you know, Germanic Norse pagan imagery in their ceremonies.
Yeah, we've actually got some recruitment videos from Azov. Let's play them and have a look. We get a sense of that. So what are we seeing here?
Yeah, so this is one of their kind of torchlit ceremonies. They do that for new recruits, and also they do that to kind of do farewell send-offs to, you know, dead fighters who've been killed fighting the Russians and fighting the separatists. This is Karpatska Sich, who I met in... They weren't very friendly to me. I met them in Western Ukraine, in the far west, in the Carpathian region. They also fight in the east. They also have support from the government. Even when I was in Kiev last, a few years ago, in the main shopping street in Kiev, there was a kind of poster celebrating, you know, their Karpatska Sich's efforts fighting the Russians in the east. But they are just objectively neo-Nazis. Like if you go to the town, they're based in Uzhgorod.
I mean, it almost looks like a kind of ISIS.
Yeah, it looks far more like an ISIS video than anything you see in, you know, in Western Europe, certainly. You can see the Azov shield. So they've got the Wolfsangel rune, which was also used by the SS Das Reich division, and I don't know if you can see behind it on the shield, there's the black sun symbol.
There was a tweet a couple of days ago which actually came from NATO, which was celebrating International Women's Day, and one of the images of a female soldier, it was noticed by people on social media, actually was wearing this black sun symbol.
Yes, and I mean it keeps cropping up awkwardly in these kind of promotional photos of soldiers who aren't on the surface, you know, Azov fighters or members of kind of extreme right-wing militias.
Does it mean they are part of the official Ukrainian military but have sympathy for these far-right groups?
It could mean that. I mean, it's difficult to say for sure without knowing the context in which these photos were taken, but even regular Ukrainian soldiers over the past few years keep kind of embarrassingly being, you know, shown wearing SS regalia or, you know, morale patches that hark back to kind of SS symbology. So like the SS you know, runes, the lightning bolt runes, or, you know, the SS Totenkopf.
This black sun symbol, what's the actual history of that? What does it mean?
Heinrich Himmler, who was the leader of the SS, he was very into all this kind of neo-pagan kind of, you know, very symbolic, esoteric symbolism. So in Wevelsburg Castle in Germany, he created...
Which is Himmler's castle, is it?
Yeah, he wanted it to be like a kind of Camelot for the SS. So for senior SS officers, he wanted, you know, this to be their kind of nightly base where they'd, you know, perform various ceremonies and you know, take over the world. Set in the floor of Wewelsburg Castle is this kind of giant marble mosaic of this symbol. It has no meaning. Like, it isn't some kind of prior pagan symbol. It has no meaning or context outside.
So Himmler just designed it, did he?
Or someone designed it for him, but that's where it comes from. And it's since been taken on as a symbol of esoteric Nazism.
What does esoteric Nazism mean?
Esoteric Nazi ideology believes that Hitler was literally a deity. He was a god. And it worships Hitler as a kind of avatar of the
so
divine.
It's a religious movement, yeah. Almost.
Yeah, basically. So it's like a very cult-like, occultic form of Nazism, right? I suppose even within a kind of Nazi or neo-Nazi subculture, this is like a very...
fringe.
Yeah, it's a fringe belief. Even within the kind of Nazi subculture, the most extreme Nazi elements within the kind of Ukrainian political sphere are exiled Russian neo-Nazis. So there's a guy called Alexei Levkin, who's a leader of a group called Votanjugend, which is allied with Azov. It's been sheltered, given support by Azov, he is an esoteric Nazi. He's a Russian ultra-nationalist. He's against Putin because he thinks Putin's too left-wing, essentially, that Russia has too much, you know, non-white migration. And they're fighting alongside Azov. You know, when I was hanging out with Azov in Kyiv, Votanjugend had a shop called Militant Zone inside Azov's headquarters. Azov's headquarters itself is owned by the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense. It was given to them. It's in central Kyiv, just off Maidan Square. And that's really become a hub for neo-Nazi and extreme right activity from across Europe. So they do national socialist black metal music festivals where, you know, bands from France and Sweden and Finland and Russia all, you know, go on and do their kind of Nazi thing.
So are these Russian nationals who are...
Yeah, Russian nationals. And they've been... one of their big campaigns recently has been to get Ukrainian citizenship with Azov support, because they've been fighting against Putin, they've been fighting against the Russian army in the east, but for their own essentially purely Nazi purposes.
And during this campaign, do we have any idea what the Russian neo-Nazi component are doing? Are they fighting against Russia?
Yeah, I assume so. In fact, in Mariupol, they'll probably also be fighting against Ukrainian citizens who identify as Russians in the east, the separatists.
Is it different to other countries? This is a question we asked a previous interviewee, and he said that if you look at the electoral results of the far-right political parties in Ukraine, they actually only add up to 1.6% in total, which is actually less than some individual far-right parties in other European countries have achieved. So by that evidence, he says there is no neo-Nazi problem in Ukraine.
That is true. That is absolutely true. So electorally, they're very weak. All the far-right parties together couldn't clear the very low bar to enter the Ukrainian parliament, right? So in terms of mass support in Ukraine, they don't have it. Like, the majority of Ukrainians would obviously kind of reject this ideology, all this kind of stuff. So in that sense, what Putin is saying is wrong. However, the problem is, it's not the correct comparison comparing them to kind of right-wing populist groups vying for election in Western Europe or elsewhere in Europe. The issue is they are armed and funded by the Ukrainian state. You know, they have tank units, they have artillery units, like, they're very heavily equipped.
I think we've actually got an image of some NATO arms being handed out, or it's some kind of shoulder carried missile. And the first battalion, it says here, that was being instructed on how to use it was the Azov regiment.
Yeah, so here we have, you know, very modern anti-tank weapons, probably provided by Britain, right? Probably the guys being blacked out there are, you know, British trainers. You can see the Azov logo there, the Wolfsangel. There's another guy wearing the Wolfsangel there. So
it's not only supported by the Ukrainian state, it's also being directly armed by Western powers.
Yeah, so until very recently, there were very strict rules. Like the United States, Canada made it very clear that no arms they would supply to the Ukrainian army would go to Azov because of their concerns about the threat Azov posed to the Ukrainian state and to Ukrainian civil society. Obviously now, in the current situation, that seems to have fallen by the wayside a bit. And I think there's a comparison that could be made with, jihadist groups in Syria or, whatever. Groups like Azov are because they're so ideologically committed, they make very good fighters. Like, you know, they are very, very good fighters.
So they're useful.
Extremely useful. They're extremely useful to the Ukrainian state. But they also represent a potential future threat. And I think, like the jihadist problem in Syria, there's a tendency in the early stages to underplay the potential threat they represent because, you know, people in the West would ever think it provides useful ammunition to the enemies of the broader project.
So what is that threat? I mean, if there wasn't a neo-Nazi problem before this war, there might be afterwards, because I would imagine that their popularity will increase because of this battle. It feels like if they are waging the kind of defensive efforts in these key cities of Kharkiv and Mariupol and so on, people will probably support them more after the battle is over.
Yeah, you'd assume so. I mean, you know, you see the, you know, like the Ukrainian National Guard have been, you know, promoting Azov's efforts in Mariupol.
What is the threat to Ukraine afterwards? So let's say,
I think the
after this war is over, what role will these neo-Nazi groups have? What threat do you see them posing?
I suppose the way to answer that is it depends how the war ends, right? So if the war ends, as I think is likely, with the Ukrainian government having to cede territory in eastern Ukraine or, you know, give up its claims to Crimea, then groups like Azov particularly, they represent a threat to the stability of the Ukrainian state, because they can say, like, you know, we refuse to accept this. In 2019, I spoke to Elena Semeniaka, who's Azov's international director, and I asked her, you know, does Azov still see itself as a revolutionary movement? And she was very clear that in the event, she was anti-Zelensky, in the event that Zelensky became what she called a puppet of Moscow, then she said, you know, we have a plan for using our influence within the Ukrainian state to, you know, prevent any loss of territory or any kind of betrayal of the Ukrainian state.
So any settlement that redrew the Ukrainian boundaries in some way, mm-hmm. whether losing those provinces in the east or surrendering Crimea more long term, would probably be unacceptable to Azov and these ultranationalists. And so they might actually potentially use those arms to, I don't know, fight against the Ukrainian government. It's almost equivalent to the IRA or the Irish settlement in the 20s. Are we looking at that kind of situation?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the primary risk. I think the primary risk groups like Azov represent aren't to Russia and probably aren't to, you know, Western Europe, but are to the stability of the future Ukrainian state. So for now, yeah, they make great fighters. You know, they're defending Mariupol against overwhelming odds. Very committed, you know, fighting very hard. But in a few years' time, you know, maybe a couple of years ago, there was a kind of unanimity that we, you know, we shouldn't give anti-tank weapons or certainly not, you know, anti-aircraft missiles to groups like Azov. That seems to have changed very quickly over the past few weeks, with not really much discussion about that. And that's something in a few years we might potentially think was a mistake.
Finally, give us a sense of the scale of this. Obviously, it's not the majority of Ukrainian people or even the majority of the armed forces. Do you have any sense of numbers, both of people who support these movements, mm-hmm. members of the wider movement, or even the military themselves?
In absolute numbers, like, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny proportion of, you know, the Ukrainian population. So I think no one really knows for sure, but I think the last reliable figures for Azov were about 2,000 active fighters at any one time. In the wider Azov movement, which includes its political party and, you know, the National Corps and the National Militia, which are the kind of policing auxiliary militia, which helped the Ukrainian state by policing cities like Kyiv and Kharkiv, maybe 20,000 people maximum. We don't know how the war's changed that. Maybe they've attracted more recruits. Maybe some of those 20,000 people who were committed to the broader movement but weren't active fighters have now become active fighters. We can't really say for sure at this point.
And what about Beletsky? Where's he?
Last I saw him was on Instagram in Kyiv. He seems to be having some role in the defense of Kyiv. He said he was recruiting in Kyiv on social media. He's also been kind of releasing threats to the Chechens who are outside Kyiv to come on and face him, you know, man to man. So Chechens versus Azov.
Aris, thank you for explaining that to us.
Always a pleasure.
That was Aris Rusinos with us here in the studio at Unheard, talking us through the reality of the neo-Nazi situation in Ukraine. It's something that's hard to talk about because it's been so much part of the Russian propaganda and their reason for invading. But clearly, it is an unusual situation where there are active neo-Nazi regiments or paramilitary groups supported by the Ukrainian state. At the moment, they're being very useful. They're good fighters and they're part of the defense of the country. We'll see in coming months and years whether that becomes a bigger political problem. Thanks for watching. This was Unheard.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.